It's the 9th of November 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Can we get through an entire segment on the Pirate Party without doing a single pirate impression? Stay tuned, me hearties, to find out. What's the result of Johnny Scaramanga's Ofsted inspection? Did philosophers shape the modern world, or are they just a socio-linguistic construction, observing itself whilst being teleological? Should we experiment with how we explain the scientific method? And how can you cook the perfect cheese toasty? But first, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do consider going to our website at poddelusion.co.uk and subscribing and donating £5 or £10 a month. All the donations are put towards paying various costs associated with the podcast, such as hosting fees and the like, and who knows, if everyone who listened donated, we could quit our jobs and do the podcast full-time and make it even better. So please do subscribe and donate, or make a one-off donation at poddelusion.co.uk. But now let's get on with the show. Now, we start the show this week with the forthcoming by-election in Manchester Central, where one of the lesser-known candidates is Loz Kay, the leader of the Pirate Party. Despite Britain's long history of novelty by-election candidates, Loz isn't a man who has a parrot on his shoulder. But instead, he's campaigning for digital rights and a whole host of other modern techie issues. You know, the sort of stuff we're always harping on about, basically. So, given the by-election is coming up, I thought it was a good opportunity to find out what the Pirate Party was all about. And I started by asking him how the campaign was going.
Well, it's going very well, I mean, in terms of actually just getting out and reaching people. But there is something which is pretty disturbing. It's basically how powerless people feel. Manchester Central has a real problem in terms of lack of democratic engagement. Approximately half people actually basically don't vote in local elections. It's worse, right? In the centre of the city, just 13% of people took part in elections. And that's right across the demographics. It's really, to me, it shows why a movement like the Pirate Party is needed. We talk about accountability, using the ideas of how the internet functions, of really an inclusive kind of politics, because clearly things aren't working as they are right now. Frankly, it's quite distressing to see how many people are telling us that basically they're feeling disenfranchised and don't want to vote. It's up to us to show them that there is an alternative.
That's fascinating. I take it as a very digitally savvy party, are you guys in favour of, say, internet voting or something in the future?
Well, the real problem is that there's no one quick fix. There's real things that we should be doing to engage people much better online. And that's, of course, why we've always been saying that anything like site blocking or it's really anti-democratic, because anything that reduces people's ability to engage online and be online is also stops them taking part in local democracy. But there's going to be no one single thing that fixes it. We've always been in favour of democratic reform, proportional representation, House of Lords reform, but frankly, these seem like pretty kind of distant hopes right now, given that the failure, in particular, of the Liberal Democrats to deliver on that. So it's going to be a long, hard slog, but it's actually about showing that people can be involved in the policy process, that it's not about just us politicians or politically engaged people having all the ideas and imposing on them. It's actually really getting out there and actually involving people in the decision-making process.
I understand that you've crowdsourced the manifesto as well. I found that fascinating. How did that work?
Well, yeah, there's something that I'm particularly happy about that we've managed to do over the kind of last year. What we were hearing is that people liked what we stood for civil liberties, for digital rights, for accountable and transparent politics. And that was fine as far as it went. And we needed to broaden our platform out and to include more things that people are interested in. interested in. So basically, we set out a process where we said anyone could submit ideas to us, not just party members. It was kind of using a sort of Reddit format, is that people could put in a policy idea, it could be debated in that way, people could comment, and crucially vote things up and down. And it was all done in relation to our party principles. That was really exciting because so many great ideas came out of it. And we got about 3,000 people involved in that whole process, which to me is pretty exciting. And I hope that that's the way forward. Going back to this idea that policy should be about coming from a wider pool of people, because that's really seems to be, to me, what we can learn from how the internet functions and the idea of the wisdom of crowds and swarms.
Where would you say the party fits anywhere in particular on the sort of traditional left-right axis? Looking at your manifesto, it seems to be quite a left-wing sort of thing. You know, I'm all in favour of that, but I imagine the sort of the digital rights core of things also appeals to, say, you know, libertarians and the like as well.
Well, absolutely. We're trying to move things on from that old idea of that left-right axis, that's always something that we've rejected, because we need to be thinking in new ways in 21st century politics, really. That said, we need to be clear about what we stand for. Sometimes, if you say, "Well, we're not left nor right," then you kind of end up sounding sort of you're not standing for anything. But there's a very clear core to what we believe in, which is about essentially the sharing of knowledge, the participation in society. So these are things which are certainly have ideas which have social conscience. Put it that way. That's what interests me in politics, and what I think is what we should be doing and aiming for. But it's certainly not about trying to put in and kind of any sort of authoritarian platforms. We're interested in business, but in terms of a small scale, I mean, innovative, rather than big faceless corporates. That's, I think, where we're coming from right now.
One of the interesting things about the Pirate Party is on the website you actually host a proxy for the Pirate Bay, allowing people to bypass the block that ISPs have put on access in this country. I mean, why did you guys decide to do that?
It's really interesting. One of the things that we've been clear about constantly throughout our history, both as the UK party but as a movement worldwide, is both the dangers of site blocking and, of course, the futility of site blocking. Particularly the last is, I think, evident to anybody that spends any time online, frankly. But we've always taken that we have to see that in a political context. The background to the proxy to Pirate Bay was that initially it was set up in relation to blocks in the Netherlands. So it was in solidarity, as it were, with our Dutch counterparts. But as most people will be aware, that now the major ISPs have been forced by injunction to block the Pirate Bay site here in the UK. Now, what was been hugely frustrating about that is that the government indicated that they were not minded to bring forward the parts of the Digital Economy Act that had provisions for site blocking. I mean, Ofcom recommended against it. So it's about two different pieces. Technically, it's about two different pieces of law. But the reality is that we've ended up in the same place via injunctions, and the government hasn't done anything. Now, we see it as our job, as also politically active and campaigning, to do something about it. So essentially, it was there to illustrate the futility, but also, as we see it, the duplicity of the coalition government. It's particularly disappointing that because and the coalition were making some very good noises about civil liberties, but seem to have, again, this is yet another of the areas where they've let us down as we see it.
So it's not about accessing pirated content per se, it's more about the principle of site blocking. Given you are the Pirate Party, do you have a position on the Pirate Bay itself, as it were?
Well, our interest, as I say, is political. It's about the kind of principle about what should we be doing as a country. I mean, we can now see that there's absolute evidence in terms of the dangers of this. We've always warned that this both was a slippery slope to censorship in this country, but sent out a bad message to other countries. And we can see steps happening, for example, in Russia at the moment, and our Russian counterparts are also doing work there. What's really interesting, how the Russian story was reported, was very much in the context of civil liberties. But we're also we're asking kind of fundamental questions about what are we actually trying to achieve? That's what interests me as somebody that is interested in terms of evidence-based policy. No one from the big music and film industry lorries have actually ever tried to show an achievable positive goal for any of this. There's no possible way to kind of measure the kind of effectiveness. To me, surely the question should be, if we're interested in actually rewarding artists, and you know, I'm all for that. That's right, also in the core of our policy. And then saying, but this is not the way to do it. We've seen, for example, again, look at the evidence. You can look at Denmark, which has had a Pirate Bay block for some years now. Actually, we had better growth in the UK in terms of the music industry than they did. So it's saying, what are we trying to achieve, and what is the evidence? And that's really where it all falls down to me.
So what would you envisage as sort of the new business model? How should these big companies and the big industries adapt to the 21st century?
Well, yes, what is the way forward? This is obviously it's the question. For us, it's absolutely, it's time for common sense copyright reform. Really, actually, what we're asking for, in terms of the current manifesto, it's not that radical in that what we're saying is actually just reduced copyright to a 10-year period. This would allow still possibility of making money in the old way. And you can't tell me that 10-year term makes business impossible, because you can just look at it in other fields in terms of patent law. Then what we have to do is that we have to look at really making sure that we have an internet and web that functions well. Really, the point is that what we need to be looking for is much more direct selling. This is why the big companies are so worried about the agenda that we're trying to put forward. To say, actually, we don't need you anymore. The one big thing that the large companies still provide, of course, is marketing. But now we need to be looking to much smaller models, but also leveraging social media, for example. And this is happening, and it will happen. You know, whatever the kind of progress of the dismal Digital Economy Act.
It's a fascinating topic, Aaron. I mean, it's something we've covered at length. I'm personally on board with everything you're saying about this. But one thing that I wonder, and we cover a lot of science policy on the show as well, and we've covered the problems with getting funding for sort of basic research before, but it ultimately comes down to, is this an issue that people, that, you know, the man on the street cares about? Are people on the doorstep when you're campaigning raising these issues with you? Is this something we can get politicians, you know, elected on?
Sure. I mean, that's great. I mean, that's really the key question. I mean, a constituency like Manchester Central, where we're campaigning right now, is hugely diverse. I mean, it has lots of digital businesses. It also has some of the most excluded estates in the entire country. Yes, it's fair to say that most people don't mention copyright reform on the, you know, the proverbial doorstep. But what they do know is that not being online can affect their children's education outcomes and their job prospects. I've had precisely those conversations. They know that digital exclusion stops them from participating, and even things like getting cheaper energy tariffs. And also, equally, talking to business here in Manchester, I've been at meetings where business owners have been complaining in pretty strong terms that they feel that they simply don't have the infrastructure to allow their businesses to sell nationally and internationally and really grow. We've heard a lot recently about particularly money put aside in the budget for digital infrastructure upgrades. It's simply ridiculously inadequate. Again, we've had a sum of £12 million put aside here for Manchester, for example, and simply the promises that are being made is really inadequate. And it's also saying that all of these things that people, those things are actually bread and butter issues now. It's almost redundant to talk about the digital economy because the economy is digital now.
It's an absolutely fascinating topic area, and I could talk to you for hours about it. But I'll let you get back campaigning, and we'll put links to find out more about your candidacy in the Pirate Party on the Pod Delusion website. Loz Kay, thank you very much. You can find out more about Loz Kay on Skeptical Voter, which is an amazing political wiki outlining political positions of many prominent political figures in the UK. Point of disclosure: I'm involved in Skeptical Voter because it's amazing. So you can find out more at skeptical-voter.org.
Election reactions. Richard Littlejohn said, "With minorities flocking to Obama and America's demographics shifted, can a middle-aged white man ever get elected again?"
Now, regular listeners to the show may remember the shocking and fascinating reports we've had by Johnny Scaramanga looking at the accelerated Christian education curriculum used by some private Christian schools. Now, this week we bring you the latest twist in the saga. Johnny has uncovered some information that could be interpreted as though there may be a potential conflict of interest between some Ofsted inspectors and these Christian schools. Maybe. To explain more, here's Johnny giving us his personal take on events.
In Britain, Church of England schools are part of the furniture. We're so familiar with them that we tend to assume that faith schools are all cuddly, tolerant places which children of all faiths can attend without discrimination. Places where only a minimum of indoctrination takes place. I'm concerned, then, about Britain's minority of independent faith schools, which teach, in many cases, very extreme views, but are subject to almost no scrutiny. I've previously reported for the Pod Delusion on the accelerated Christian education curriculum, used in over 50 British private schools. Accelerated Christian Education, or ACE, hit headlines earlier this year when the Scottish Herald reported that on its science curriculum, ACE is teaching that the Loch Ness Monster is evidence that dinosaurs are still alive today, a fact which, they say, discredits evolution and supports creationism. Elsewhere, the curriculum describes evolution as an indefensible theory and repeatedly states that no transitional fossils exist. It's not just ACE's science curriculum which is questionable. In history, ACE has taught that the reason Britain defeated the Spanish Armada was because it was God's will. If Spain had won, the logic goes, then America would have been Catholic. It was always God's plan for America to lead the world with the only true faith, Protestant Christianity. In politics, ACE teaches that God's views are right-wing, and that the term left-wing is so given because left means sinister and twisted. Students are taught that all forms of government healthcare and social benefits are against God's will. With such a worrying curriculum, it's paramount that these schools are subjected to rigorous and objective inspections. So I'm shocked to discover that one Ofsted inspector charged with reporting on these schools is a Mr. Stephen Dennett. When not inspecting for Ofsted, Stephen Dennett is curriculum writer for Accelerated Christian Education. He's currently writing their British Social Studies course, for which he takes payment. And he was formerly employed in a senior management position by Christian Education Europe, the distributors of ACE materials. He's even written a book, A Case for Christian Education, in praise of the ACE curriculum. It is impossible that Stephen Dennett can provide a sufficiently rigorous inspection of accelerated Christian education schools. But the first page of a Google search turns up four ACE schools he's inspected: Carmel Christian School, Mustard School, Beehive School, and the Christian School of London. Of course, this isn't the first time the authorities have been happy to turn a blind eye to lower standards in these Christian schools. I've previously told the Pod Delusion how UK NARIC, the body responsible for assessing the comparability of international qualifications, has deemed Accelerated Christian Education's qualifications on a par with A-levels. And then there is the Bridge Schools Inspectorate. The Bridge Schools Inspectorate is a collaboration between the Christian Schools Trust and the Association of Muslim Schools UK. This immediately gives me pause. The Christian Schools Trust, CST, is a highly conservative body representing around 40 British schools. In 2006, the CST polled 12 of its schools. 11 of them were teaching that evolution was false, with the 12th head teacher stating he did not know what position his school took on evolution. An earlier study of 52 of these Christian schools by Geoffrey Wolford found that almost all taught the Bible's 6 days of creation as literally true. I grew up with these kinds of Christians, and I was taught that Islam was a religion inspired directly by Satan to lure people into hell. Its similarity to Christianity was all part of the plot. While the Christian Schools Trust might not use exactly those words, I'm sure they would say that Islam is a false religion. And they would agree, according to John 8:44, that Satan is the father of lies. So, according to this theology, we're back with Muslims as followers of the devil. Why, then, would the Christian Schools Trust collaborate with Muslims? It seems to me it's because the formation of the Bridge Schools Inspectorate allows them to inspect their own schools, thus avoiding any unsympathetic inspectors. Mind you, if Stephen Dennett is anything to go by, that fear may be unfounded. The first objective of the Bridge Schools Inspectorate is to protect and to promote the religious ethos and philosophy of our school communities. I'm not sure that this is a religious ethos that deserves protection. As a former student at a fundamentalist Christian school, this looks like a cynical exercise in mutual backscratching. The CST is willing to jump into bed with Muslims rather than face inspection by a body which might question its teaching of creationism. There is also an assumption present in reports on faith schools that teaching of values and morals is automatically good if the curriculum is Bible-based. This assumption needs challenging. At my ACE school, Catholics, Muslims, liberals, gays, and especially humanists came in for a huge amount of abuse. These schools need very searching inspections, and that can't happen while they're inspecting themselves or using their own curriculum writers as inspectors. This is Johnny Scaramanga reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Election reactions. Jack Westmoreland said, America was founded and made great by WASPs. These same people are now considered out of touch in modern America. God help us all.
Now, one thing we've covered a lot on our programme is that of the nexus between free speech, censorship, and the draconian use of law in controlling social media. This week, yet another example of this minefield was exposed, as Alex Fitch now explains.
Even with the promise of a more liberal America on the cards, with the re-election of Barack Obama this week, an aspect of anti-liberalism, censorship, has become a hot topic closer to home over the last few weeks. Sex crimes have been the focus of two abuses of the media. The BBC's burying of an episode of Newsnight last year, which could have revealed the Jimmy Savile scandal several months earlier than the recent discovery of his sordid history when the TV cameras were turned off. And at the other end of the spectrum, 9 people from Sheffield and North Wales were convicted this week for revealing the identity of a rape victim on social media sites. It's hard to decide which is the more unsettling story. 2 weeks ago, an episode of Panorama looked into the claims that the BBC pulled the Newsnight report on Savile because it clashed with programmes that were scheduled to air at Christmas praising Savile's work, and concluded that the evidence was mixed, with further investigation to come. Certainly one thing that is obvious from the developing story is that many, many people who worked in the TV industry over the last 40 years suspected there was something salacious about the former DJ's affection for children, but said nothing, implying a combination of a climate of fear and self-interest at the corporation, where people who wanted to say something didn't, because they didn't know if they'd be believed, and didn't think any information they proffered would go any further. In the 21st century, with the proliferation of social media and the public's instant access to it via smartphones, tablets and computers, it is very difficult to keep allegations, character assassination and libel quiet. The seven men and two women who admitted they revealed the identity of a woman raped by a Welsh footballer thought it was okay to smear her on social networking sites such as Facebook and Twitter, and another pleaded not guilty and will appear in front of the court again in January. Over the past few months, there have been several people arrested for making provocative statements on the internet, which range from the ridiculous, a man charged for clearly making a joke about blowing up an airport, and threats of legal action against celebrities who support him, to more serious cases such as the identities of other public figures who had tried to take out super injunctions to stop them being pre-accused of various crimes. This is a murky situation where the law is having to quickly adapt to a brave new world of limitless information it clearly didn't see coming. However, while the law is having to encompass new technology, it's clear that a basic knowledge of what is and isn't legal in terms of contempt of court and related issues is something that perhaps needs to be taught in schools. Even before I started a course in journalism last year, I knew it was illegal to reveal the name of someone who had been raped, unless they later perjured themselves in court over the issue or decided to reveal their identity themselves. A factoid I must have picked up watching some legal drama on screen or reading a newspaper article. But morally, with the trauma felt by rape victims for a great time after their experience, you would think, to use a legal term, right-minded individuals would realise spreading this person's identity would be a horrible thing to do. However, these 9 or 10 people, depending on the view of the court next year, decided that not only would they reveal this woman's name, but victimise her further on the internet. One thing I didn't know and subsequently learned in my training is that the notion of publication of information that might cause contempt of court has further implications regarding websites. Previously, sensitive information about a trial or arrest taking place couldn't be printed in newspapers once someone had been arrested for a crime, as it might influence current or future jury members, and this ban is lifted once a trial is over. But this piece of law, when applied to the internet, means that pre-existing pages have to be censored, as people, while not expected to look in old newspapers, might use search engines. So every click on an old website that contains sensitive information is considered a republication of that info in the eyes of the legal system. Even with this part of the law not known by most people, it doesn't seem inconceivable that most people know that taunting and outing a rape victim is the wrong thing to do. On Breakfast TV this morning, Prime Minister David Cameron was unexpectedly handed a list by Philip Schofield of people in positions of authority that were being mentioned online as paedophiles. Cameron, shocked, obviously decided not to read out the list. Presumably Schofield and his producers were upset the media were being censored over this when social media isn't being curtailed. But the Prime Minister rightly believed that it might lead to a witch hunt. This sort of thing has happened in the past, when tabloids have decided to print names of paedophiles, leading to innocent people with similar names or similar addresses having their lives ruined, let alone anyone who was falsely accused in the first place. While social media has advantages that traditional media doesn't, and also vice versa, at least in the past week, examples of good old-fashioned investigative journalism have been shown to have not disappeared in the 21st century, with journalist Kostas Vexevanis being allowed to out thousands of rich Greeks who were evading tax in Switzerland while their country slides towards bankruptcy. However, even with social media often seeming like a bear pit, its current lack of censorship can also reveal the rich and powerful when they are trying to hide crimes or plausible accusations of crimes from the public. For all his self-engineered 1980s publicity of eating furry pets as snacks in lurid gutter press headlines, it hadn't occurred to many people that Freddie Starr might be mixed up in the Jimmy Savile scandal. However, on the 4th of October, when he was outed on Twitter as taking an injunction out against newspapers for even suggesting the possibility of a link, this created suspicion in people's minds, which might not have happened if he hadn't tried to gag the media in the first place. And as it turned out, he was eventually arrested last week. It's hard to know where to draw the line. Simplistically, one might suggest that celebrities, particularly ones who court infamy and can afford notorious publicists and lawyers, should have to weather lurid claims and libel because they almost expect it, while ordinary people should be protected from libel on social media as it can destroy lives. Perhaps the only way that people will realise what is right and wrong before the government decides to add this to the education curriculum is through outrage when people break information laws that are morally wrong on Twitter, and also outrage when people are arrested for not actually breaking the law online, but are put behind bars anyway. As I mentioned at the start, we live in a more liberal world than we did a week ago, assuming that the old maxim of where America leads, Britain follows is still true, as not only have a party that wanted to quantify rape, but also demonise the poor, was rejected by the American people. But also more states now have legalised gay marriage, and a couple have even started legalising pot. Obama's victory tweet has become the most retweeted message in the brief history of the site, while media reproduction of asinine and backward comments by Republicans and their pundits make the opposition party look even more barbaric and unelectable for the foreseeable future. If social media can not only help further a liberal world, bearing in mind the role it played in the Arab Spring, one hopes that Twitter and Facebook can begin to police themselves, with users helping to save the innocent from arrest, such as anyone who makes jokes that shouldn't bother anyone with a brain, and condemn those who take the law into their own hands, such as the 9 charged so far for breaking the Sexual Offences Amendment Act. It is a brave new world we are all living in, and one hopes that access to communication and information for all will help society escape its barbarism and not nurture the still existing pockets of it. This has been Alex Fitch for The Pod Delusion.
Election reactions. Kenneth Harbin said, "Obama isn't even a real black. He's the son of a Kenyan. His family isn't from the black American struggle."
Now, if you listen to our show regularly, then chances are that you'll probably be a bit of a fan of the sciences. But what about the philosophy of science? Yes, I know, hang on, I know the likes of Brian Cox and Stephen Hawking think that it's a load of rubbish, but our next guest would argue that it's really rather important. Stephen Trombley is an American author and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker who's just written a new book called 50 Thinkers Who Shaped the Modern World. From Kant to Derrida, the book has all sorts of people who, if you name-drop them, you'll sound really clever. So as you might have guessed, Stephen's a very clever man as well, which is why I got our deputy editor, Liz Luckendorf, to do this interview. Personally, I'm just left wondering if their words are merely an intersubjectively validated series of noises, and therefore, can we really say that an interview took place at all? I mean, objectively speaking. To find out, here's Liz talking to Stephen, and she allegedly started by asking him how he defines a thinker.
Well, it's something we thought about a lot, the publisher, editor, and myself, because people, in fact, someone just asked me, well, why don't you have Steve Jobs? Why don't you have Henry Ford? And the answer is because they are doers. The thinkers are defined really as people who have a body of work so large and probably so systematic that it couldn't be ignored. It's like a boulder in the intellectual landscape. You're going to bump into it. And you have to contend with it because it'll be a body of thought that had an enormous effect. So choosing 50 since Kant, you could say, might be difficult because there are so many, and I would argue there aren't so many. We probably had 150 or 200 names on the list. You know, people like Rachel Carson, you know, or C.L.R. James, But when it came down to that kind of definition, you know, I think we'd be hard pressed to hit 60.
One thing that I noticed is that most of them, if not all of them, are Anglo-European or Anglo-American or Spanish, some European. Are there no one from outside Europe in that? I imagine you're probably getting that a lot, so you probably have a good answer for it.
Well, when we sat down to do it, I'm going to take you back to when I edited the second and third editions of the Fontana Dictionary of Modern Thought with Lord Bullock. I looked at the first edition and I said, this is all Western thought. There's nothing really, the whole Eastern tradition, which is enormous, is absent from it. And I was told, well, that's for a reason. It would be twice as big. And I said, well, we could cut down some of what we've already got. We could edit it down and make room. And the answer was no, from the publishers. But the when you say Eastern, I mean, or Oriental, it's like a world even bigger than the Western one. How big would that book be? And it certainly wouldn't be written by me, who knows very little about it.
Okay. Fair enough, fair enough. I hear you were grilled a bit on Woman's Hour as well about, was it Woman's Hour, about the lack of women, because there's three.
There are three.
And my throw out of there is like someone like Elizabeth Cady Stanton or even Grace Hopper.
Well, I'm
going to... It's my two mean questions.
Sure. Well, and I'm going to give you just a straight answer. Neither of those persons contributed a body of thought so large and so massively important as any of those people who are on the front cover of this book. These people are big chapters. They're the main, they're the motorway. And people like that are B roads and some A roads.
Cool. Well, I was going to ask about Auguste Comte because he kind of informs a lot of my research because he's given loads of short shrift in historical circles. So why is he important for us?
Well, one of the reasons why he is in there is I thought it important to elevate some people into, you know, second and third divisions and also to drop some down. You know, Bertrand Russell, boom, demoted. Hannah Arendt, bang, up there in the premier division. He is important because the methodological thing alone counts for enormous amount. So that someone who, I mean, Edmund Husserl, who I think is the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, the phenomenological method, it wouldn't even matter if he hadn't published his conclusions. The fact that he laid out a program of research that any of us can use, and many people did, Martin Heidegger, and better yet, Hannah Arendt, makes him very important. So I think Comte is important that way. That's an enormous contribution to give a method.
I liked at the end as well, you had this little bit about philosophy of science. And we interviewed loads of scientists and covered all that. And some of them really hate the idea of philosophy of science. So how do we bring them around? What's of interest to them to take?
I wouldn't bring them around. I'd fire them. Why would you want to bring them around? They're incomplete people.
Really?
It's a foolish, foolish way to behave, to exist extra-historically. Are you kidding me? It's a cardinal sin of thought.
One example, I guess, for you bringing that up is Sam Harris's book, The Moral Landscape, which was heavily criticized because he just dismissed is ought and all that sort of stuff. Is that the kind of thing you're driving at?
No, I'm driving at Stephen Hawking, for instance, saying in his latest book that philosophy is dead. Are you kidding me? That is the silliest thing I've ever heard. I don't care how much physics he's done. It's silly and it's foolish and childish. Because every philosopher from the pre-Socratics to the modern period really were scientists. They didn't have the tools yet that we have, like microscopes or telescopes or sophisticated measuring devices or even knowing what the structure of our world was. You know, Democritus knew about atoms, but he didn't know how complicated they were. Those people looked around them and tried to figure out, without a religious or other, mythical explanation, what is this, first of all, and why? And so they were scientists. They were asking scientific questions, but only able to give, if you like, philosophical answers because they didn't have experimental data, they didn't have mathematics, they didn't have logic, they didn't have a lot of things. As time moves along, the philosophical urge, the philosophical attitude becomes scientific. Newton is a thinker, but he's actually able to figure out actually the basic, the principle of gravity, which is then considered a scientific pursuit. But it's hard to think of any aspect of applied science and technology that does not have a philosophical component about its use.
I guess one of the criticisms you could get is that some people might see how some of these people have influenced, like Darwin and Marx and things like that, but others, it's hard to see in the modern street that people would see how it would influence them. So how do you take these ideas and how are they applicable to someone watching X Factor?
It's when you look at someone like Frege or Russell, who work in an area of mathematics and logic that is so advanced that most of us, I mean 99% of us, have no idea what they're doing. I don't. Yet, it's very important because it changed the course of philosophical history. Britain, Hegelianism, was the prevailing philosophy of the United Kingdom until the middle of the 19th century, right up until the beginning of the 20th. And together, G.E. Moore and Russell decided to kill it. And they did. They very successfully, within a matter of years, cleaned Hegel out of the universities and replaced them with analytic philosophers, a condition which exists today in 2012. So that's enormously important. Now, the fact that we can't understand, most of us, what Russell did mathematically matters little against what he did, but it's kind of a technical achievement. Now, in my competitor, Bertrand Russell, in his history of philosophy, denigrates his contemporary Henri Bergson, who is another one that I would bring, if not into the Premier League, into the First Division, because he was a wonderful popularizer of complicated metaphysical ideas. And even in translation, he reads so beautifully. And he could explain his thinking to anyone. Anyone with half a mind can understand what he's saying. And I think that ought to be a goal of philosophy, to be useful in the sense that it may be highfalutin serious thinking, but that I can tell you what it is, you can see what I mean, and then decide whether that has some relevance for you or not, and possibly may influence the way you think about things, the moral choices you may make. But it's nowadays, most philosophy is written for academic advancement. It's papers written by philosophers for other philosophers so that they can get tenure or keep it. And the subject matter is not of interest to the ordinary person. Now, some philosophy can't be. I mean, their modal logic is modal logic, and I don't think you can probably make it sexy. But I think philosophy has to maintain a relevance to our lives because we are guided by thought. We should think ourselves, and when we see models of good thinking from other people who have encountered the same problems, we learn from that, and perhaps we become philosophers ourselves and move it forward a little bit more.
So another interesting thing that you mentioned in the book is that you probably don't think there's any more superstars in philosophy. Do you think we're just too close to our present to actually see someone? Will it take 50 years, 100 years?
That's exactly what I think. I think that to be a superstar in your own time, well, look, in the middle of the 20th century, it happened. Both de Beauvoir and Sartre were superstars, still are. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think of philosophers, if you ask people at the bus stop who are philosophers, they might think of Jean-Paul Sartre. A.J. Ayer probably was the last one in this country that, you know, everyone would know of, and, you know, whose Language, Truth, and Logic sold millions of copies. It's still in print. Nowadays, it's hard to think of who could be in a position like Sartre, de Beauvoir, or A.J. Ayer in this country, partly because the work of contemporary philosophers is very technical, and often it is completing problems set by previous thinkers.
At the end of the book, there's this litany of things that are kind of against the idea that philosophy is dead. What do you think are going to be the ones that grip us the most, the ones that we're going to be trying to answer from, you know, for the next 50 years?
all of the Western democracies face incredible challenges from terrorism. And how a civilized and balanced society responds to that kind of irrational violence, which is the product of unreason, I think judges will be judged by that response. Now, you can't, you have to do something. You can't just let it be. But how much of our own humanity are we willing to sacrifice to stop Al-Qaeda, for instance, which by its very definition is pretty unstoppable as a kind of virus that spreads with hit-and-run tactics and, you know, a cellular structure that is unlikely to be penetrated by the CIA anytime soon or ever. So it really requires, if you ask me, people in government able to think philosophically, to be able to think ethically, to be able to think in the tradition of political philosophy, what do we do? And before the Air Force is called in again, I think it would be a good idea if philosophers were asked to sit at the table, because these sort of problems are the type of problems that they're used to. The particularity is just the particularity of them. So that is one area. Another area is really in the realm of ethics to do with new technologies that have resulted from scientific breakthroughs, anywhere from, you know, right-to-life issues to things like the Human Genome Project, genetic engineering. The thing of assisted suicide is really, it's a nagging and important subject everywhere in the West. And the arguments for and against are cogent and more or less convincing, depending on who's making them. They have the problem of being tied up inside religious practice as well as just common sense and intellectual reason. So they are always with us. They're always problematic. And they raise real issues of self-determination. Never mind do we allow religion to control our lives and make decisions, but how much are we going to allow another person, a doctor, for instance, to make those decisions, or a legislator? And there are many, many people in terrible pain towards the end of their life, and you may well ask the question, why must they not be allowed to end their suffering or be obliged to be a morphine addict slowly dying? I mean, these are really big questions, and they cannot be answered by technology. The technology already exists. The technology is why we're asking the question. So ethics is required, and we are all of us called upon to be ethicists. So I suggest we all get reading before we die.
And maybe a tricky question for you. Everyone, you probably have your favorite philosopher who you could have included, but was there someone you really dislike but is on this list?
Bertrand Russell.
You really dislike Bertrand Russell?
Horrible man.
Well, he was quite a... He had quite an interesting personal life.
He's an absolute bastard, isn't he? He's anti-Semite, he's racist. He's one of the most unpleasant people you could hope to meet.
That's amazing. And to end on a slightly better note, who's your favourite?
I would want to be on a desert island with Schopenhauer.
Thank you very much. That was possibly the most enlightening interview we've had on the podcast. So, yes.
And we'll put links to find out all about the book and buy us a new letter on the Podtolution website.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Election reactions. Clickman 8 said, Obama's America is not my America. Obama represents the end of America and the beginning of socialism in America. Vote Mitt Romney! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark.
Now from philosophy to the scientific method. In this next piece, Paul Hopwood talks about the challenges of finding the best way to communicate just how great it is. Personally, I think the best way of finding out the best way to communicate the scientific method is to systematically change parts of the explanation each time, making notes of the results each time, and then adapting the technique to whatever fits this situation best. If only there was a name for this. With more, here's Paul.
The first time I ever came into contact with the skeptic community was when I attended the talk of my very good friend Tom Williamson in Leeds. His talk was entitled The Scientific Method, Uses and Abuses, and provided excellent explanations of various pieces of scientific jargon and some very clear examples of how the scientific method has been correctly and incorrectly used. I was extremely happy to see this talk because, for my money, the scientific method is one of the great accomplishments of the human mind. As a result, I made a conscious effort to come up with as clear and concise a way as I possibly could for explaining both the method and its importance to others, whether in discussion or debate. The method I came up with was to point out that there is a stark choice when it comes to exploring and guiding ourselves through the reality in which we find ourselves. The first is that we can base judgments on no evidence or faith, and the second approach is to actually use evidence as a foundation for our thoughts, opinions, and theories. What the scientific method has been developed for is quite simple: to produce the highest quality of evidence possible on the basis of current human understanding, and that is, again to the best of our current understanding, what it does. The evidence to support this claim comes from the phenomenal success rate of accurate future predictions that have been made based on scientific evidence compared to any other attempts to make such predictions. This method of explanation has worked suitably well for me so far, but there is one thing that puzzles me, and that is why have I never come across anyone else referring directly to the quality of evidence produced by scientific research. I'm not making this point from a position of considering my own explanation to be superior to what has gone before. Rather, I am genuinely concerned that I might be missing something obvious, which is common knowledge to others, but which I have somehow managed to keep on missing. I can see that there are various reasons as to why this approach might be a bad idea. For instance, the use of an absolute statement, in other words, science does produce the highest quality evidence, as far as we understand, could be setting yourself up for a rather large fall, especially if you find yourself not having the relevant evidence on a particular topic to hand. It would seem to me to be rather embarrassing to find myself in conversation uttering something along the lines of, "Well, science has produced the highest quality evidence with regards to this matter, but unfortunately, I don't know what it is." On a rather more serious note, however, what concerns me more are another two practical problems with using such a bold factual claim. And the first is that it might actually seem to be rather arrogant. From my own personal experience, the perceived arrogance of science and scientists is one of the two main objections that people have expressed to me as to why they hold a negative view of the subject. This strikes me as yet another case of evaluation by what has been said being based on who has spoken and not an attempt to evaluate the words themselves, one of the most common and, in my view, annoying of all human traits. Bearing that point in mind, though, I presume I have to remember one of the lines from my own skeptics talk, namely, perception is a two-way process. In other words, it doesn't matter what I know and understand compared to others. That doesn't mean that others will simply change or are in any way obliged to change their negative opinions about science, and that I also have to consider the way that I put my message across. The second is that science can produce rather bleak conclusions about the future of mankind and the universe. A lot of people are very negatively emotionally affected by this, and simply don't like what science has to say. I think this hits the same problem as the previous point. I can say, for all I want, that science doesn't care and isn't democratic about what the individual thinks or how they would like the universe to be. It is simply trying to answer the question, what is going on, to the best of human ability. However, once again, just because I think and accept that does not oblige others to in any way, shape or form. Therefore, regardless of what I think about the validity of my explanation, I may be able to persuade more people of science's importance simply by not including a statement that could be perceived as being so overtly arrogant and decisive. I'm sure that my natural enthusiasm will try and dismiss this as pure fiction, but only time will tell. However, I have only used my explanation in discussion with others and never in a debate, and I have a feeling that could make a difference, and I will be interested to find out what happens in this regard in the future. So, what, if anything, am I missing? Do the points I have mentioned above hit the nail on the head, but I just haven't realised until now, or am I missing something else entirely? I would be very grateful to hear others' views, especially those from people who have had greater experience of communicating the scientific method, or using scientific evidence in any kind of a debate against non-scientific evidence, than I have. In the meantime, this is Paul Hopwood and his musings for The Pod Delusion.
Election Reactions. EduACSP said, "If you're an American Catholic and voted for Obama, I must say something. You're already excommunicated for being a communist candidate."
Okay, so we've been through the philosophy of science, and then we've tried to figure out the scientific method. But now let's finally put the science to some good use and see if we can make some decent food. In a brave new move for the Pod Delusion, Sarah Castor-Perry this week brings us the recipe for the perfect cheese toastie. If you've got an electron microscope, do feel free to cook along at home with her. With Sarah, here's more.
Sometimes nothing else will do but a crispy, savoury, oozy toastie. A staple of students, the short on time, the hungover and cheese lovers everywhere. But which cheeses are the best to use? Well, science can help you out. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of cheeses, let's take a quick look at the chemistry of milk itself and how different ways of treating it when making cheese can affect whether you'll get a proper gooey, toasty centre. Cheese is essentially pressed curdled milk, and when we say curdled, what we mean is that the proteins in the milk have been altered. Unlike the proteins in eggs or in meat, the proteins in milk are very heat tolerant. You can pretty much boil milk dry without the proteins curdling or coagulating. This is because the curd proteins, or caseins, that look kind of like little hairy balls, are negatively charged and so repel each other. When we curdle milk, we stop the balls from repelling each other and allow them to clump together into curds, leaving the watery whey behind. One of the easiest ways to do this is to add an acid. This neutralises the negative charges on the casein balls. But what it also does is dissolve the calcium holding the balls together, a bit like dropping some limestone into a beaker of acid. And it also changes the shape of the different proteins in the whey, known as denaturing. So the casein proteins and the whey proteins join together into a strongly bonded mesh that makes for cheeses that don't melt very well, because with heat, instead of the proteins moving apart from each other, the cheese just loses water. So this includes cheeses like Indian paneer that can be cooked in curries without disintegrating, and Italian ricotta that stays put in blobs on pizzas. These types of cheese would definitely not be the type to use in a toastie. So which ones would? Well, the majority of the cheese we eat is made by curdling the milk with rennet, which contains enzymes that affect the casein balls differently. They essentially shave off the negative charges, allowing the balls to clump together, but without affecting the calcium or the whey proteins. These cheeses are much more likely to give a good melt. Now, I personally like a mixture of gooey and stringy in my toasties, so let's deal with each of those in turn. The most important factor for gooiness in melting is water content. High water content in the cheese dilutes the proteins that make it solid, meaning they're more weakly bonded together and will flow past each other and melt at a lower temperature. You don't want to be cooking your toastie until the outside is burned just to melt the cheese inside. Watch out for using high-fat cheeses in a toastie. They're more likely to leak melted fat as the protein network breaks down with heat, and they can make the toastie greasy. Though, to be fair, that is often part of the enjoyment. Now, to stringiness. The reason a cheese goes stringy when it melts is that the calcium that I mentioned before in the casein balls starts to cross-link those balls together, joining them up into long strings. Cheeses tend to get less stringy with age. The first reason for this is that as a cheese ages, more and more of the milk sugar lactose is converted into lactic acid. Acid dissolves the calcium holding the casein balls together, stopping them from forming stringy ropes and making them fall apart and flow more easily. The second reason is that over time, enzymes from the starter cultures of bacteria added in the cheese making start to break down the balls of protein into tiny pieces that are just too small to link up into chains. So, for the gooiness, go for moist cheeses like Fontina, Gruyere or Monterey Jack. And if you're a string fan, then add a couple of slices of cheeses like Emmental, mozzarella or some young cheddar. Happy toasting! This is Sarah Costa-Perry for The Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for the Pod Delusion this week. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3 years of archives, follow us on Twitter, and like us on Facebook, if you're into those sorts of things. Also on our website, if you have enjoyed this show, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. We would really like your donations to help us keep building this show to make it better and better every single week. So please go to poddelusion.co.uk and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Johnny Scaramanga, Alex Fitch, Liz Luckendorf, Paul Hopwood, Sarah Castor-Perry, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The in-between bits of the US election quotes were found by Blakely Nixon and read by Alex Foster. Do go and check out Alex Foster's new audiobook, because he really does have a beautiful voice. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Nadine Dorries is the first sitting MP to appear on our reality show, but she didn't ask permission to do it. At first, Dave Cameron considered calling her back.
But instead he's decided to jump on the bandwagon.
So we welcome you to our updated lineup as the government reconvene in our hit show.
I'm a celeb Tory! Get me out of here!
Deep in the concrete jungle of Westminster, the contestants have been set a series of gruelling challenges.
First up is George Osborne. His challenge is to balance the budgets before the time runs out. Otherwise, the majority of the country will not be able to eat tonight.
And he's given it his best. Oh, and as the timer clicks down to zero, he just succeeds in his challenge.
Yeah, by slashing benefits, so the majority of the country will not be able to afford to eat tonight.
And now Cameron himself is undergoing an endurance challenge. He's sitting behind the desk, looking confident. The door opens.
Oh, Nick Clegg enters, squirming his way across the seat of power. Cameron is looking uncomfortable, but he manages to stay in control.
The door opens again, and in comes Nadine Dorries. We all know how much DC likes to be around her since Frustrategate.
But he still seems to be holding on, and the door opens for the final time.
And it's Angela Merkel, striding in to demand that the UK stays in the EU. And that's enough for Cameron. He's banging on the door and crying to be let out.
Bad luck, Dave. That won't go well with the viewers.
It definitely looks like he'll be facing eviction over this one.
Aye, but sadly not until the election in May 2015.
Oh, come back, let me to OPIC. All is forgiven.